So it's great to come to Pittsburgh and be able to talk about the Roosevelts. And I wanted to begin with TR, let you know that Theodore Roosevelt's born in 1858. What does that tell you? Tells you that the Civil War was a big part of his childhood. His mother was from Georgia and was pro-Confederate. His father was a Knickerbocker from New York and was pro-Union Army, and young TR liked the West. He thought the South had screwed it up with slavery and secession, and the North had ruined things with hyper-industrialization, and he got almost a fantastical vision of what the New Eden of the American West would be. This New Eden came to him courtesy of boys' magazines of the late 1860s, but particularly the 1870s. I mean, you had the Hayden Expedition in the 1870s showing Yellowstone, and those photographs from that would start appearing in these boys' outdoor magazines. In a magazine like Backcountry Journal, there would be first time you'd see features of new places in the West, and he wanted to go see them. After that, his father was a founder of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. In fact, the American Museum was born in the birthplace of Theodore Roosevelt by his father, a man named Alan Bickmore. They wanted to make a natural history museum in New York, something that would be more potent than the British Museum. Young TR started collecting nests and started doing taxidermy. He had as a teacher the last apprentice of the John James Audubon, John Bell. And so young TR became very proficient at small mammals and taxidermy. And of course, in those days, if you loved the outdoor world, you couldn't look at, in order to study birds, you'd shoot them. You wanted to study eastern bluebirds, you'd look at 100 of them and look for variation in feather coloration, beak size, etc., to try to do it. And TR decided he wanted to be a naturalist, professional. His father warned him he wasn't really good at science, that it's a lot of laboratory work. What TR liked was the big swashbuckling adventurers, outdoorsmen. But I said he was born in 1858, and in 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origins of Species. That's a game-changing book. Was it a game-changer for the soldiers fighting in Shiloh or Gettysburg? No. But when your father's founding the American Museum of Natural History in New York, Darwin was the revolution within the revolution. The first childhood drawings we have of TR is showing him evolving. My brother's evolving from a dog, I'm evolving from a stork, and a little handwriting of an eight-year-old, Darwin's theory of evolution. We've got that from Theodore Roosevelt, his early childhood Darwinian influences. But part of his love of Darwin wasn't just his scientific theories, but the whole idea of collecting and traveling and his journey to the Galapagos and thinking about the evolution of species and the like. He goes to Harvard wanting to be what today you would call majoring in wildlife biology, naturalist studies. He gets more and more involved there. As an undergraduate, Theodore Roosevelt writes his first book. It's really a chapbook. But it's called The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. He started doing inventories of them his entire life. But his senior year, when he went to Harvard, he went up to Maine to follow in the footsteps of Thoreau. He went to Mount Cahaden, which President Obama signed as a national monument due to the generosity, really, of Roxanne Quimby, of Burt's beeswax fame, who bought all that land in Maine and deeded it to the federal government. It's this beautiful new national monument we have in Maine. TR hiked that whole area as an undergraduate. He then went his senior year with his brother the furthest west he'd ever gone, western Iowa, Carroll County, far western Iowa, and he fell in love with it. His favorite book was Francis Parkman's Oregon Trail. He has this seminal moment when he's out there in Iowa and then the Red River Valley of Minnesota around Moorhead, Minnesota and Fargo, North Dakota. He wrapped a buffalo robe around him and, he was just living out this sort of Western fantasy. Came back from that trip, got involved with politics in New York, and was there in Albany as a Republican reformer, progressive, and a runner came with a Western Union telegram that said, it was from his brother, and it said, Theodore, get to back to Manhattan, where he was born. Mother is high fever. Your wife, Alice, is giving childbirth. He got on the train as soon as he could. It was a Valentine's Day. He got into New York City. And on one house, his mother was burning up with a 104-degree fever. On another floor of the same house, his wife was having a difficult childbirth. He spent the wee morning hours going floor to floor, floor to floor, and they both died that night. He lost his mother, and he lost his wife. They both had a dual burial. You could go to the gravesite in Wall Street. It's right near where Alexander Hamilton is buried. And he put a giant X through his diary. It's one of the historians like myself, we look at people's leavings for a living, letters, diaries, to see the original Theodore Roosevelt almost cutting the paper with a giant X and writing, only the light has gone out of my life forever, is quite a sobering experience. And luckily, his sister, the baby, survived. It became Alice Longworth Roosevelt, the famous Washington social maven. His sister took the baby and told Theodore, go west where you're happy. He famously went to North Dakota, got off the Pacific Railroad, and that becomes his storied years in the wilderness in North Dakota. If any of you want to experience some of that, you just have to go to Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Go to Medora, North Dakota. He became a rancher, had two brands, for the Maltese Cross and the Elkhorn Ranches. He became a writer of the Little Missouri River ecosystem. He went into the Bighorns. He'd often do fair chase stories of looking for a bear or an animal as a way of writing his naturalist prose. I would argue to you, he still has written some of the most beautiful writings of the Badlands of North America, as anybody. His writings are included with Edward Abbey and Rachel Carson and the like, as just being seminal writing of this period and place. The big deal for him, guys, and one point I wanted to make today, because so much you could say, is he had an insight that I thought was very valuable. Everybody going west in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s were going to make money. They were going for railroads and gold mining, zinc, asbestos, copper, timber, not TR. He was a man with a Western vector, never going to look for any money really out of the West. I mean, he ran this little cattle thing, which was like a concierge kind of cattle ranch ultimately. What he recognized is we had no biological inventory of the West. We didn't know what kind of prairie grass. We didn't know what kind of insects. We didn't know what types of species were out there in these places. There were places still unmapped. There were still wilderness areas. So he thought, well, we need our guidebooks for every area of the country. We need to know, as the great United States, we needed a survey of what our species, our flora and fauna was. And it's sort of, if you call it the Wild West, for a biologist, it was the Wild West. You can make a big name for yourself discovering new species. He got himself into a big debate with C. Hart Merriam, one of the great mammalologists ever. Merriam was more than that. He became an expert on native culture and a genius figure. They debated T.R. and Merriam at the Cosmos Club on how many subspecies there are. For example, T.R. thought there were only in America four kind of bear, and Merriam thought there were actually, you broke it down, and that you could have 12 different by snout variations and all of this. And if you were only wanted four, you were considered a lumper. And if you wanted a lot, like Merriam, you were a splitter. Merriam was arguing on behalf of science. He's saying, actually, I am scientifically correct. T.R. said, you're never going to save or care about species if you don't even know them. If you make too many, nobody's going to be able to keep track of them. And so sometimes you do have to, I don't want to call it dumb it down, but simplify it so people can understand. You're talking about the general public, more popular science, let's call it, versus the academic science. ETR killed him at the debate, slaughtered him. He was nobody outdebated Theodore Roosevelt. You have no idea what TR would do to Donald Trump. Honestly, he was a ferocious debater and orator. But what he ended up doing, Miriam went out to Washington State and discovered the giant elk that had a larger rack and a different type of elk. And Miriam said, writes TR after losing the big debate, "Dear Theodore, I've just discovered a new elk, and I've decided I wanted to name it the Roosevelt elk. However, I know you're not in for too many of these breakdowns, so I thought I'd seek your permission." And TR said, "Okay, in this case, you're right. You know, please, I'd be honored to have it named the Roosevelt elk." And of course, if you go up to Olympic National Park area, you can see that elk, and you live out that way, and you see, you know, it's... So he stayed spirited with all this. His hero was John Burroughs. In your magazine, in your hotel room, there's a story of the vagabonds, John Burroughs, Firestone, Henry Ford, and Edison all traveling the country. They left here and went down the National Road and then made their way down to Asheville on a road trip. But Burroughs was a big deal. When Burroughs went with Edison and Ford out of Pittsburgh on this journey, you can read about it if you're still here, in your hotel magazine, if you haven't already, Burroughs was as big as Edison and Ford. He was a household name. Burroughs' books were bestsellers on nature, deeply underrated conservationist. And TR worshipped Burroughs. He called him Oom John, my Dutch uncle. He would get some money and give poor kids all of Burroughs' books on nature, TR, when he was police commissioner of New York. He goes on, and lives a storybook life, Theodore Roosevelt, as you probably know, not just police commissioner, but assistant secretary of the Navy. He goes to the Alamo at the Manger Hotel to recruit volunteers of the Rough Riders and fights in the Spanish-American War, wins the Medal of Honor posthumously for his charge up Kettle in San Juan Hills, and then becomes governor as a war hero, as governor of New York, and immediately starts pushing forward wide-ranging conservation edicts, mainly curtailing pollution, curtailing clear-cutting, stopping the shooting of songbirds. One could go on and on. TR had chronic asthma. As a child, he was sick in New York City. He'd go to the Adirondacks and Catskills and feel better. His whole life, he connects the clean environment with health. And he swears by that you got to have cities that have green belts to get away. Otherwise, the hyper-industrialization will choke you, kill you. He was keen on the respiratory illnesses that could come from these unregulated factories here in Pittsburgh, the inferno of Pittsburgh that was going on. One real quick point about him, guys. He was biophilic, as Professor Wilson at Harvard calls him. Biophilic means he always had to have animals, birds. He would have just been in heaven here at this facility. Nature, signs of nature, plants on tables all the time. He usually had about 35 pets at any time when he was president, and he had a pony that would take the elevator in the White House. He named it the White House. It used to be called the Executive Mansion. He called it the White House. He kept his pockets full to feed squirrels nuts. He wrote the best book on bird inventory of Washington, D.C. while he was president. He would go with the great John Burroughs to camp down in Charlottesville. You can visit their cabin called Pine Knot there. He went with Burroughs to Yellowstone. And then he went to Yosemite with John Muir. And then he went to the Grand Canyon and stood on the lip of the Grand Canyon, looked out at the divine abyss, and said, "Do not touch it. God has made it. You only mar it. Leave the Grand Canyon alone." Powerful commentary. Problem is, Senate goes to mine it for zinc, asbestos, and copper. There were no senators in those days from Arizona. It was a territory. And Roosevelt looks for a way to save the Grand Canyon. Nobody wants it saved. And he finds the Elastic Antiquities Act of 1906, which was originally formulated by John Lacey of Iowa, a former Civil War Union hero. Lacey loved prehistoric bones, dinosaur bones, and Native American relics. And the European museums, particularly the Scandinavians, were coming and stealing our antiquities. People from Norway, Sweden, Germany were coming here and taking these things for their museums. And so Roosevelt used Lacey, had created this act, really meant in spirit, let's call it 10 acres, 20 acres, let's call it 60 acres. But the idea was, if you think of the yellow plastic of a murder site, you know, you're supposed to quarantine it off because these T-Rexes belong to the American people. And, you know, yeah, we're going to become part of the American Museum of Natural History and our great finds. And Roosevelt couldn't stand our antiquities being taken out of the country, nor did Lacey. But T.R. applies that to the Grand Canyon, 600,000 acres. Today it's over a million. But he signs an executive order, 600,000. Holy hell broke loose for doing that. He went through the court system in T.R. 1. The big challenge was, in the Antiquities Act, it says a president has executive power for scientific reasons. Grand Canyon, Roosevelt said, show me a better example of erosion at work. If you want to study the erosion, let's study it there. That is science. And of course, he's known now as president for doing all these national monuments. Some came easy, like Muir Woods, which was a gift from William Kent, the great redwood trees up in Marin. You know, some like Devil's Tower, you know, he was our first. But he creates the monuments. He does parks. The national parks, you all know, have to go through Congress. So Crater Lakes, his, and Mesa Verde and the like. But beyond that, the big thing he did, and the underrated part in what environmental journalists need to keep a very close eye on right now, are our national wildlife refuges. Roosevelt creates our first 51 federal bird reservations. The first one is up, Cynthia's down there in Florida. Its first one's Pelican Island, Florida. But because 100 years ago, every woman here, even though you would say you wouldn't, would have come to my talk right now wearing a bonnet with an ornamental feather on a Sunday here. And those ornamental feathers were egrets and heron, sometimes dead hummingbirds. But they would, you would come with it. It was the fashion style of the time. And the problem is, nothing screams for federal regulation more than bird protection. I mean, you can't save the birds of Pennsylvania to have them slaughtered in Texas, right? So you're going to have to create flyways and play, and you're going to have federal laws. With seeing the decimation of the birds of Pelican Island, Florida, where people would take guns and just go gun them down, pluck feathers, steal the eggs, wiping out species. And this is an era of species being exterminated. We're living in one of those eras now. But, you know, we lost the Carolina parakeet. The last passenger pigeon, Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo in 1913. The last human to see and do an official report on a passenger pigeon in the wild was Theodore Roosevelt in Virginia. He was keenly aware of species dying off. Wasn't going to let it happen in Florida. Ask his lawyers what will stop me from declaring Pelican Island region on the Indian River a federal bird reservation where no humans can go without a pass. They said, well, they hadn't been hauled. And he said, I so declare it. It became our first. He did that 51 times. Some of these bird reservations are like the Yukon Delta in Alaska, or the size of West Virginia. They're all over. They saved the albatross in Hawaii Islands. You can look into the grid of the 51 federal bird reservations executive orders. Today we have over 550, and we've got 550 because of his fifth cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, building on the 51. He's created U.S. Fish and Wildlife in 1940. Rachel Carson used to work for Fish and Wildlife. She did pamphlets. You can get her unsung writings. We all read her Sea Trilogy and Silent Spring, but you could read her little booklets on the National Wildlife Refuges. Her job was doing radio broadcasts promoting protection of these wildlife refuges. T.R. died in 1919. He famously had gone to Africa as ex-president, the Amazon explorations. He was shot running a third party, Bull Moose Party, where he took a bullet in Milwaukee. was bleeding profusely and refused to go to the hospital. So he came up to the podium, covered his wound, and said, "It will take more than a bullet to kill a bull moose." And went on lecturing for an hour. Eventually, what ended up in a lot of the rest of the campaign in a Chicago hospital with Jane Addams sitting at his side of Whole House fame. She, of course, won a Nobel Prize. The fact that Jane Addams was sitting at Theodore Roosevelt's side and that Jack London, who backed TR in 1912, he had called London a nature faker, TR, for lying about wolves' characteristics in Call of the Wild and White Fang. That London backed him. Roosevelt had captured the hearts and souls of progressives and socialists in 1912. And big part of it was his environmental crusading. As president, he saved 234 million acres of wild America. He created this whole idea of just massive parts of our country protected. Nobody filled his shoes after he died in 1919 until Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. As president, FDR, if you want to know about FDR, all you got to do is know about TR. TR's from New York. FDR's from New York. TR grew up trying to preserve local areas. FDR grew up preserving. TR went to the state legislature in Albany. FDR goes to state legislature in Albany. TR was the head of Fish, Forest, Wildlife. FDR, head of Fish, Forest, and Wildlife. Theodore Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, FDR Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Theodore Roosevelt was Governor of New York, FDR's Governor of New York. Theodore Roosevelt loves Big Navy, FDR loves Big Navy. Theodore Roosevelt's all about conservation, FDR's all about conservation. Theodore Roosevelt Theodore Roosevelt has a niece named Eleanor Roosevelt, and FDR marries her. That's how close these two are. So you want to understand why when we look at the public lands, it's about the Roosevelts. It's about both of them. Because FDR in some ways did more far-reaching things that affect our modern condition. By the time he came in 1928 as governor of New York, first off, the big moment in FDR's life was when he ran in 1920 to be the vice president. He was on the ticket of James Cox of Ohio. The handsome young FDR was on a ticket in 1920, and Warren Harding beats Cox. FDR had been all over as the VP giving speeches, and now he's unemployed. He went back to his great sacred landscape, the Hudson River, Hyde Park, New York, where FDR was born, raised, lived, represented. Always remember, FDR represented rural people. He was not New York City. He represented upstate New York and everything he did and thought. 1921, on a job, he said, "What would Theodore Roosevelt do?" TR had organized and ran the Boy Scouts of America. FDR runs the Greater Boy Scouts of New York, and FDR comes up with an idea, we're going to pay all expenses paid for all the poor kids of New Jersey and New York, Pennsylvania. They're going to all get to come to Bear Mountain State Park on the Hudson River for a free jamboree, learning Indian woodcraft and horseshoe and fishing and outdoor life. The idea is to get kids out of urban tenements and slums, get them for this all-paid vacation, really, up in the Hudson River. He got boats to take everybody up there. He was the grand impresario of it all. And in fact, he acted and played with all the young boys that long weekend, and he went swimming with them, and he contracted the polio virus. And polio manifest itself for a few days, so he left Bear Mountain. Many of the boys got polio from the dirty water, sewage, you know. William Ruckelshaus, I did the oral history for the first head of the EPA, William Ruckelshaus, asked me to interview him about 10 hours on tape for University of a combined project for Washington State and University of Washington. And Ruckelshaus said to me, "The problem with you environmental historians, you don't write about sewage treatment. It's all about the sewage treatment movement. And everybody leaves it out because they want to do Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon." He has a point. But FDR goes up to New Brunswick in Canada, and he puts out a forest fire on a little, forestry is his passion, FDR. He runs a tree plantation at Hyde Park, and he, Gifford Pinchot is giving him advice. Pinchot is the chief forester for TR, and he then woke up with migraine and had no feeling on the lower half of his body. Eleanor Roosevelt gets him into a hospital in New York, and he goes back to Hyde Park on the Hudson to birdwatch. His first essays, FDR and TR, are all about birds. They were both lifelong birders. If you go into Theodore Roosevelt's or FDR's home, you will see bird collections. FDR had was doing just like TR did. Nobody wanted to be with FDR. Why? Because you were afraid you'd get polio. You get too close to him, you might get polio. We didn't know about it a lot, so suddenly he's sitting in Hyde Park at his home. Nobody wants to be with the guy who 6 months earlier was the VP nominee for president. And it shocked him. The person who did come with him, who wasn't afraid of him, was Manswell Crosby, the top ornithologist in the state of New York, upstate, outside of the American Museum, where it had some real pros. But Crosby was a great ornithologist, and FDR, feeling sick, depressed, and lonely, said, what did TR do when he felt sick and depressed and lonely? TR went to North Dakota. FDR goes to the Everglades and to the Keys. And he gets a boat to go do a bird count, see how many birds he can find in Florida with his ornithologist friend, Crosby. We have a letter from him here in the mid-1920s saying we got to save Everglades. It's a national park. He's able to do that in 1934, although it doesn't manifest itself into the Truman era. And he's the leader of the state park movement of the 1920s. In fact, the convention like you're having here, all the state park advocates met at Hyde Park to try to decide how we can do these state park grids. Well, FDR becomes governor in 1928 and then governor in 1930. He has Warm Springs, Georgia, a polio resort and a forestry project. And it's not just the banks foreclosing and unemployment at 25% in 1929. The land had been denuded. And it's not just the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma and Texas or something. It's all over. They clear cut the forests. We had soil erosion. Topsoil had gone. Horrible agricultural practices. The land was blighted. And Roosevelt comes in bringing scientific forestry, soil conservation, and helps to start healing the nation. And one thing he does is create the Civilian Conservation Corps. Unemployed men, and there was a group called the She also. They got paid $1 a day for planting trees, building picnic areas, beautifying areas. Between 1933 and 1942, Roosevelt Work Project, basically the CCC, plants over 3 billion trees. Billion trees in the United States. Changes everything. He starts, it's the beginning of managing of land, managing of wildlife, managing of resources, managing of game. They create things like Pawtuxet, where you can study how to bring back the beaver, how do you bring back, like TR did the buffalo at Wichita Mountain, our first game reserve. FDR is trying to bring all the species back. His love of birding's there. I'll end by telling you when FDR, two quick stories to let you know very quickly how this worked, for how important this was. Pearl Harbor, wow, what a day. That very week, Roosevelt gets a letter from Rosalie Edge, conservationist saving hawks here in Pennsylvania, Hawk Sanctuary. Protector of birds of prey, the great Rosalie Edge. If you don't know her, read up on her. She's a giant. And Edge gets a letter. She's a socialist. Gets a letter through to White House saying, basically, if your administration keeps the 10th Mountain Division at Henry's Lake, Idaho, 15 miles west of Yellowstone, Henry's Lake is where the trumpeter swans stay. Because the lake doesn't freeze, and instead of migrating, they stay there for the winter. And now we've penned a $24 million alpine training army base there to train our skiers, cross-country, demolition, to fight the Nazis. And in Europe, mountain demolition crews. but they're disturbing the Trumpers. And if they continue with their exercises at Henry's Lake, it might mean, and this is not the end of the Trumpeter as a species, no other president I know of would have taken a letter like that seriously at Pearl Harbor time. Roosevelt investigates, and he writes Secretary of War Henry Stimson, "Dear Henry, I have now found out about the war between the Army and the Trumpeters."
Wow.
"I've looked into the matter very closely, and the verdict is in. I side with the Trumpeters. The U.S. Army must denest. Sincerely, Franklin D. Roosevelt." He shut down a $24 million facility, and they had to build Camp Hale in Colorado, where, incidentally, a young guy named David Brower went through, who had become head of the Sierra Club. But the point being, why? Does he just love Trumpeters? He built these systems. Theodore and FDR built our wildlife systems, our forests, our monuments, our parks, as Cynthia said, for America, for us. It is America. You're fighting the Nazis. You're fighting for the Trumpeter swans. You're fighting for clean air. You're fighting for clean rivers. You're fighting for parks, state parks. Now, it is America. It's the DNA of the country. And if he knew if he let the Army molest and kill off one species there would be abuses. He was sending a very loud message to Stimson and the War Department. We're not going to be gouging timber. We're not gouging. We all know we need resources for war, but these were built permanently. They're not transitory. D-Day, the other great day, right? You know what happened on D-Day in the environmental history? June 6th. June 4th, he goes to Charlottesville to go birdwatching FDR. He comes in. He doesn't want the media, you guys, press, to notice anything unusual about him. He comes in and keeps all of his schedule. And on June 6th, the big meeting is a delegation. He's going to create Big Bend National Park. And there he goes on D-Day, gives his famous prayer to the nation on D-Day. And as soon as he's done with his prayer, he meets with Amon Carter of Fort Worth and a delegation and spends over an hour looking and designing where picnic areas and vistas and all should be at Big Bend. And creates June 6, 1944 is the birth of Big Bend National Park. Commitment. Month later, he's writing the president of Mexico, "I got a great idea. I don't think it was to build one giant bipartisan or bi-nation run park on the Big Bend. It makes no sense to have the Rio Grande cut off from Mexico. It's one whole ecosystem. Let's save the ecosystem together, and we'll make it be jointly administered by the United States and Mexico on the border." In the middle of the summer of 44, he's trying to expand this park down there. That's how visionary they are not. And FDR and TR make mistakes. TR was extraordinarily gifted and famous hunter. He did not actually have, it wasn't as good of a hunter as people think he was because he had bad eyesight. He was blind in one eye from a boxing accident. And he always wore these big things, but he had that pursuit thing. He never quit on anything. And FDR CCC made mistakes, like kudzu. In the South, they thought that would arrest soil development without realizing they did not understand the problems with invasive species to the degree they did. But they got about 85% right, the CCC. I mean, there are some of their boondoggles are boondoggles. But you're looking at the two of them, and they changed the whole grid of America. We're still living in a post-Roosevelt age of protection. I'm now writing Silent Spring Revolution. I'm writing about what happens from 1945. Once FDR dies, just like TR, they fire Harold Ickes, the Interior Secretary, the greatest in American history, and where he's from, Pennsylvania. They get rid of Harold, and Truman puts in these guys that could care less about the natural world, continues with Eisenhower, and then by 1961 with Kennedy and Udall and Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, Rachel Carson Revolution, of 62, there starts becoming what we'll call the 60s environmental movement. But do you realize the term environmental movement was never used until 1969? when it came out of a meeting at Ann Arbor preparing for the first Earth Day in March of 1970. I'll end by telling you, you know, we have to grapple with legacies of presidents. What is it? Nixon created the EPA. Nixon created clean air and water. Nixon endangered species. And I asked Ruckelshaus, who wrote the founding document of the EPA, and he said, well, you know, it was so hurly-burly, and Nixon was so paranoid about Ed Muskie of Maine that about running against him in 72, and Muskie was on covers, Mr. Conservation of Maine. So Nixon got angry, and then Walter Cronkite and CBS was showing America in Peril, dead fish. Television turned color news in 67, and you started bringing, you know, Cuyahoga River here in Ohio on fire on nightly news in color, and Cronkite indeed. Cronkite used to do, started by Don Hewitt, back package, 30-minute news. That's 22 minutes with commercials. You do headline news. You only have one feature to follow. And just like you're seeing them follow a hurricane, CNN or something, they started following Martin Luther King or Vietnam or space. 69, CBS decided, made a conscious decision, we're going to start following the environment. Made all the difference. And Nixon then, Ruckelshaus put beautiful language together of nature with legal points and has the founding document of the EPA. Pretty big accomplishment. But it was so hurly-burly, he said, I never really don't remember the boss's feedback on it all. We just created it in the 70s. He's now in his 80s and went to go hunt down the document through the National Archives. He found his original document that the boss, Richard Nixon, had read all those beautiful points on the natural world. And there in ballpoint pen by the President of the United States, Nixon, on these points was a singular word, bullshit. Nixon created the EPA because he had to. And he had to because journalists from CBS and journalists like yourselves and newspapers started holding people accountable. They started demonizing who were the polluters. They stayed on the case. They built the movement up. And do never think that what you guys do isn't seminal, because you're it. You're the front line of it all. Your stories are going to move things. It is hard to move Flint. You get frustrated. The Flint water crisis is on the news for a week, and it disappears. I know. But it catches up. So I end by saying, keep, be a Roosevelt here. And, you know, be like Rachel Carson, and be like Edward Abbey, and be like Harold Ickes, and, you know, be like these people, and that you really love America so much that you want to make sure future generations have clean air and water, that they have, as my book's called, the rightful heritage of being able to fish, being able to hunt, being able to get lost in the wild, and being able to collect seashells on the beach at Sanibel and Captiva. You know, these are birthrights. William O. Douglas in the 60s started saying we want to have a U.S. Bill of Rights for nature, that these are birthrights that we inherited. Nobody can deny these from us. And I'm afraid we're living in a time of great, great horror going on in the Interior Department. I'm writing an essay on Zinke right now, and it's worse than you think. And I teach at Rice University and the Superfund sites down there, and what's going on post-Hurricane Harvey is worse than you think. I know some of you know some of these stories, so we all have to stay vigilant. Thank you for having me be part of your family, and I hope to be with you next year in Michigan. Thank you.